It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at Central Time, we'll find out why eating ugly food can help solve a major problem with food waste in the United States. First, despite the falling price of crude oil, you may have noticed that gas prices have taken a big and unexpected jump in Wisconsin in recent days. Some cases, gas has jumped by 50 cents or more overnight, leading to some frustrated drivers at the pump. Issues at a Midwest refinery seem to be the culprit, so what's going on there, and when could things start to turn around? We've got Jim Ritterbusch here with us now. He's president of Ritterbusch & Associates, an oil trading advisory firm. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thank you, Rob.
So I mentioned that refinery problem here in the Midwest. What do we know about what's happening there?
Well, it was a major malfunction at a large unit in Whiting, Indiana, a BP facility that accounts for about 300,000 barrels a day of production. So it's sizable, and this particular facility could be down for as long as a month. So that's tightened supplies in the Midwest.
And how big a jump in prices have we been seeing around the Midwest?
It varies, but on average, it's been around 12 to 16 cents in most areas.
Now, this runs counter to what we're hearing on the international markets. Crude oil hitting the lowest point in 6 years this week. On that end of things, why is crude oil so cheap right now?
Well, crude oil is seeing six-year lows as of about 2 hours ago. So we dropped down to below $42 in nearby WTI crude futures. And that's being driven almost directly by the shale revolution in the United States, where we're looking at highest production in roughly 45 years. OPEC has not cut production to match this increase. Furthermore, we've just had an array of negative items that included a strong U.S. dollar, the currency devaluation in China, weak diesel prices globally. So it looks like crude's going to stay under some downside pressure here for some time, and we should see this spike in Midwest gasoline prices reversed here within the next couple of weeks.
Now, I wonder if oil prices could be so low, and yet one refinery partial shutdown can bring prices up so much for gas. Is this considered in the industry kind of a bottleneck?
Well, gasoline is really the only portion of the entire energy complex that I would call balanced. In other words, supply of gasoline is pretty much right in line with the average of the past 5 years for this late summer period. When you look at crude oil and diesel supplies, we have a big surpluses in contrast. So the gasoline market is very sensitive to any what we call refinery glitches that can take a significant amount of production off the market for 3 or 4 weeks.
We're talking to oil industry expert Jim Ritterbusch about a substantial jump in prices at the pump for gasoline, despite, as we've been hearing, cheap six-year low prices for crude oil. Let's talk about the demand side of gasoline for a bit, Jim. When prices went up some years back, you know, flirting with that $4 mark in a lot of places, there was talk of us changing our driving habits, oil, demand for gasoline going down. A, did that happen? And B, are we getting back to our the habits we had before that happened?
It's the latter. We're getting back to the previous habits. As an analyst, one thing that's really surprised me this year, Rob, has been the big increase in demand. And this has been a response to the lower prices that's really cranked up driving miles considerably. And dynamic has been accelerated by lower unemployment levels. So demand is running more than 4% above a year ago on a cumulative basis through the first 7 months of this year. And historically, that's a big jump.
So we're driving more. Do we see, maybe this is outside your interest area here, are people still interested in gas mileage and new car purchases? Are we seeing those trends turning around now that gas prices had come back down?
Yeah, Rob, this year's trend has been decidedly in the direction of SUVs, large trucks, pickup trucks. As cost of gasoline and diesel have declined, you've seen gravitation toward these bigger gas-guzzling type automobiles.
Now, something that's been a political issue on and off over the years, we've heard accusations that the U.S. doesn't have enough refinery capacity, enough refineries. It's too hard because of regulations to expand current operations or build new refineries. Is that the sense from within the industry?
No. We are producing at a strong 96% of capacity within the U.S. at the present time, but we do not have a shortage of refinery capacity. Globally, there have been some huge refineries built in recent years in places such as China and India, and these Asian facilities are reducing the need for a strong U.S. Refinery activity. As a matter of fact, we're exporting huge amounts of diesel and large amounts of gasoline. There hasn't been any major new facilities built in the United States in 30 or 40 years. But at the present time, we simply don't need any more refineries.
One of our papers here in Wisconsin, I think it was the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, mentioned a couple consumers at the pump saying, hey, prices are going up just in time for August vacations and time for Labor Day weekend, saying, this is done on purpose to maximize profits during a peak driving time. Does it work that way?
No, not really. Nobody really has control of the market, and there's no concerted efforts to prop up production. We tend to see wholesalers stocking up supplies ahead of the various holidays across the summer. And when they stockpile, that tends to force what we call rack prices higher, and some of that passes through to the pump. But it's a free market here in the U.S. as far as gasoline prices are concerned.
And when one refinery cuts production dramatically for repairs, is it possible, do we have the transportation infrastructure in place for other refineries around the country to pick up that slack, and we import more gasoline from other parts of the country here into the Midwest?
Well, we can import more gasoline into the East Coast, but it's difficult here in the landlocked Midwest to let rising imports satisfy occasional shortages like we've seen here this week. So we simply have to draw more product out of the Gulf Coast region. And that takes a little time. And beyond that, we simply have to wait a couple of weeks for this refinery to come back on stream. And in the meantime, I think we've seen the worst, and I see us probably gravitating back on down as early as next week. And I'll also add that the Midwest had been about 15 cents or so below U.S. average gasoline prices. So to some extent, this is just some catch-up.
Jim, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Jim Ritterbusch, president of Ritterbusch & Associates. He joined us to talk about the recent jump in gas prices here in Wisconsin and around the Midwest. There's a lot of produce coming up this time of year in Wisconsin. Some of it looks awesome, some of it doesn't, and a lot of the misshapen, blemished, lightly bruised stuff might never make it to the grocery store shelf or the dinner table. It's part of a big food waste problem here in the United States. Our next guest found that we Americans waste over 40% of food produced for consumption in this country. There's a lot of causes and solutions being offered, and some food activists say we need an ugly food movement to help cut back on waste. Jonathan Bloom joins us now. He's a journalist and author of the book American Wasteland, How America Throws Away Nearly Half of Its Food and What We Can Do About It. He blogs at wastedfood.com. Jonathan, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, Jonathan, as I mentioned, you have found a lot of ways that we waste food. How much of a problem is this ugly food issue where food gets wasted just because it doesn't look quite right?
Yeah, well, the specifications of the supermarkets and us as retailers are really impinging on what ends up making it to that final stage of the food chain. So because we want everything to look perfect and we want everything to look roughly similar, what's happening is a whole lot of fruits and vegetables never leave the farm, and there's a winnowing process really at every step of the food chain, so that roughly half of all produce produced never ends up reaching the final stage or even being consumed.
And so all of this produce, wherever it doesn't make the cut, what happens to it?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, most of it ends up in the landfill. The stuff that never leaves the farm doesn't have quite as negative an impact, because most of that is plowed under or composted in another facility at times. But yeah, for the most part, what's happening is we are sending food to the landfill, where it creates methane, which is a terribly harmful greenhouse gas that's more than 20 times as potent as CO2 in terms of trapping heat.
And just to be clear, we're not talking about food that's gone bad, that's rotten or anything like that. It's just visually or shape-wise or for some other reason, aesthetically not up to par.
Yeah. There's a whole variety of reasons why food gets thrown out. But this particular category, the so-called ugly fruits and vegetables or the imperfects, essentially we have this image of what we want to eat, and anything that doesn't meet that image, whether it's the straight banana or the curved cucumber, in most cases that food item will end up being thrown away.
There is this, as I mentioned, and it seems like it's small so far, ugly food movement trying to get us to embrace the produce that nobody loves. Do you think that could gain traction and actually make a difference in this massive amount of food waste?
Yeah, well, it's already starting to have an impact. It's caught on in a dramatic fashion on social media. And I think the genius of this idea is to just shift the norm a tiny bit and to shake people up in their food habits and get people thinking outside of their norms. And so, yeah, maybe we don't need that perfectly round, shiny red apple, which in many cases doesn't even taste as good as some of the more gnarly, funky varieties. And tomatoes are the perfect example, where the ones that look a bit ugly, the heirlooms, in my experience and many other folks' experiences, are the ones that taste the best.
So let's take a trip to the grocery store, the produce section. What would you like to see stores do differently to get this stuff on the shelves in the first place and to present it in a way that we might actually give them money in exchange for it?
Yeah, well, there's a few things I'd love to see. First off is just a slight expansion on what is acceptable. And we have this image of the perfect fruit and vegetable item, as we talked about, and so anything that doesn't meet those requirements tends to be tossed. But in addition to that, I'd love to see some more hybrid retailers like Daily Table in Massachusetts, which is basically trying to get at that sweet spot hole in the retail system, where there are some food products that are perfectly edible but not particularly sellable in the current model. And so selling those for a bit less. And I'm sure many farmers out there would be happy to get a discounted rate for some of the food items that they're currently plowing under or composting. And so that would be one neat avenue. But at the mainstream retail level, another model we can look at is just trying to discount some food items that are approaching the end of their sellable phase, whether it's in the produce section or elsewhere in grocery with so-called expiration dates, because they don't really mean that the food's going to expire on that date, but they're really about the quality of the food. But yeah, selling some of those products that are reaching that date label for a bit of a discount.
Talking to Jonathan Bloom, author of American Wasteland, How America Throws Away Nearly Half Its Food and What We Can Do About It, focusing on ugly food, that produce that doesn't meet aesthetic standards. Wonder what you think at 800-642-1234. Are we too fussy about our produce? Do we have to have that perfectly round apple if we open our minds to differently shaped, different looking, different colored produce? Will we be happy about it? Do you think we waste too much food in this country? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Jonathan, maybe we shouldn't be calling it ugly as the movement is. I saw a big French retailer launched, I guess it translates as inglorious fruits and vegetables campaign. I kind of like the sound of that. Is it is our choice of word going to help us embrace these vegetables and fruits?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. The semantics here are interesting, but yeah, I think the ugly word gets people's attention, and I've been involved in some discussions within the field about whether or not that's appropriate. You know, maybe it's actually the beautiful ones, you know, and beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and beauty is skin deep and all that. But whatever we call it, what we need to do is just expand the definition of what's acceptable to eat. And right now we are so superficial in our approach to food. And so we want our food items to look just right. And if anything's the wrong shape, size, or color, or God forbid has a small blemish, then that is cast aside. And I'd love to see us flip that on its head and just be more accepting with our food items and not necessarily end up throwing away food items for superficial reasons.
We'll bring in a listener on this now. We've got Deborah on the line in Brown Deer. Deborah, hi.
Hi, I think you can bring that ugly food right over to Brown Deer, and we'll consume it. But my sister lives in the Upper Peninsula, and they have cemetery gardening there. And the best tomato I've ever had was a heirloom tomato. It didn't look appealing, but I love tomatoes. This was the best tomato I have ever had, and it looked hideous. But why don't you just advertise, come and pick your own and let people pick, you know, just say what you're saying now. You know, this is what we have left, if you're willing to come and pick it.
Interesting. Yeah, kind of a gleaning thing. I've been to one of those before. Deborah, thanks a lot for the call. One thing that makes me think about in that French grocery store, they had a video I saw where it shows the machinery that's selecting the apples and tomatoes and things like that. And if something's the wrong shape, it gums up the works. It doesn't let them sort it quite right. So is that an obstacle, Jonathan, to getting maybe that heirloom tomato to be easy to ship and transport?
Yeah, the mechanized harvesting can be an obstacle, but that machine is set by humans. And so it's a standard that the retailer or wholesaler or grower is requiring. And so that can be changed. But interestingly, I've seen with hand-picked crops, you know, there's that specificity and the pickers are instructed to only take things that look just right or that will last through that long-distance food chain where the average food item travels 1,500 miles. But there was this really neat program in California called Concurrent Picking, and basically the food bank had a little bit of funds, and they got some farms to pick items that didn't look perfect. At the same time, they were picking the perfect ones, and so there was a dedicated stream to get those so-called uglies to the food bank and to those in need. And I'd love to see that kind of program, that creative thinking succeed.
Yeah, we heard from Chris in Wisconsin Dells, who said the Mifflin Street Grocery Co-op in Madison used to have a free box for ugly food in front of the store. So I guess you went in and picked up the produce that they might not be able to sell. Is that another option to free or extremely discounted or donated with these foods that otherwise would end up in a dumpster or at best as compost?
Yeah, that's definitely one option. I mean, the retailer does need to stay in business, and so I think slightly more sustainable model would be to find a way to sell that at a discount, and that's what Daily Table is doing in Massachusetts, and there's a retailer out in California called Raley's and they're working with a group called Imperfect, which is sourcing some of these oddities and slightly blemished or just odd-shaped fruits and vegetables, and that would be a neat way to do it.
Jonathan, briefly, big picture, you've been sounding the alarm about food waste for some years now. Are people listening?
I like to hope so. I think they are. I hear more and more chatter about food waste every week, and it does seem like something that's in the air. This fall, I think we're going to see a real uptick in interest. There's talk of a national advocacy campaign, and that's something that would really have an impact. And what I'd love to see is a national goal on reducing food waste by a certain percentage. There are several European countries that have done so. They've set rather ambitious goals of cutting food waste by 25% or even 50% by 2020 or 2025. And I think we need to set an ambitious goal in order to achieve that kind of change, because otherwise it's just business as usual. And
we'll leave it there. Thanks to Jonathan Bloom, author of American Wasteland. He blogs at wastedfood.com. The science of happiness is a hot field today, but it wasn't always like that. For a long time, researchers were preoccupied with finding out what's wrong with us, not what makes us thrive. Enter Richard Davidson. His work studying the effects of mindfulness using tools of neuroscience have made him one of the foremost experts in the world on the brain and well-being. Davidson's work collaborating with the Dalai Lama and studying the brains of Buddhist monks, expert meditators, helped him earn the title of one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world. Today, he's the director of the Wiseman Laboratory for Brain Imaging and Behavior and founder of the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds at UW-Madison. Veronica Rickert and I talked to Richard Davidson at a recent event in Madison.
We're going to start with a basic question. What is mindfulness?
Well, mindfulness has been defined in many different ways. And if you talk to a scholar from the contemplative traditions from which it's derived, they may have a very different sense of it than the sense that is often displayed in popular media and by modern psychologists. The way modern psychologists typically define mindfulness is paying attention on purpose, non-judgmentally. That's a standard way in which it's defined. I was just very recently at a lunch a couple of weeks ago in New York City in honor of His Holiness the Dalai Lama's 80th birthday. And His Holiness was there. And I came back and I said to one of my friends, I learned something about mindfulness and what it is from being with His Holiness. And what I came back and said is that mindfulness, for as exemplified in the demeanor of the Dalai Lama, is treating every single human being like they have the full potential to be a realized Buddha, to be a kind and compassionate being, to exemplify the most positive, extraordinary qualities that are available to us as human beings, treating every single human being that way every single moment of the time, and remembering that that is really at the core of our being. And that's what mindfulness is. It's bringing that awareness moment to moment at every moment and addressing each individual in that kind of way. So it's a different way of framing mindfulness.
And you took it in a new direction in a lot of ways, trying to see what mindfulness looked like in the brain. We hear a lot about neuroscience and investigating emotions and where they come from nowadays. When you started out with this, what kind of reaction did you get telling people you wanted to research where the emotions were housed in our brains?
Well, I was treated quite skeptically at the very beginning. Emotions have had a checkered history in the biobehavioral sciences. There was a time when neuroscientists believed that most emotion occurred in subcortical structures. These are structures that sit below the highest centers of our brain and kind of have to do with the most base human qualities. And it then became apparent that this simple-minded view that largely derived from research at the rodent level, mostly with rats and mice, that this wasn't a particularly useful framework for thinking about human emotion. And that human emotion involved much more. And that when we think about human emotion and we think about life's major decisions, think about who you have chosen to be your spouse. Think about very significant purchases like a house that you may have purchased. Those are not decisions that can be easily made without emotion. Emotions inform those decisions in a very useful way, and individuals who have difficulty identifying their emotions and difficulty discerning their emotions actually have problems making those kinds of decisions. And so we then began to search for emotions in other parts of the brain that involve the highest centers of the brain, and sure enough, there is extensive representation of emotion that we find there.
And to reference the Dalai Lama's quote that began us all off, he asked you, well, you're looking at anxiety, you're looking at fear, why not apply these tools of neuroscience to positive emotions? You did that. You went and you managed to work with some expert meditators, in this case Buddhist monks, who had clocked, what was it, hundreds of hours of meditation?
Thousands? Tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands. Yeah. In their lifetimes, and you worked with them, and you looked at their brain through neuroimaging for the first time, looking at these qualities of mindfulness, of well-being. What did you find?
Well, these were really important initial studies, because we reasoned that if we did not find anything that was a clear signal in the brains of these so-called expert meditators, we were unlikely going to find signals in the brains of more novice practitioners. And so this was a very reasonable place to start. And we had the great fortune of having an amazing recruiter who can recruit these participants for us, and that was none other than the Dalai Lama himself. What we did in those early years is we flew people who resided in Asia, typically in India and Nepal, and they came to Madison and spent some period of time in residence in our laboratory, and then we poked and probed them in different ways to learn about what may be different about their brains. And the amazing thing was that very soon into this project, we began to see signals that have never before been seen in a human brain, signals that were very unusual and that clearly indicated that there was something different about these brains. And this was really the beginning of this journey. We were not able to definitively conclude that these signals were produced by meditation because these are individuals who are highly rarefied people. The average number of lifetime hours of practice among these individuals was about 34,000 hours of practice. And so you can go do the arithmetic at home, but 34,000 hours is a huge number. Most people would not make the choice to spend that kind of time doing this sort of thing. And so the skeptics said to us, well, maybe their brains were just different to begin with. While the findings from these practitioners were necessary, they were clearly not sufficient in helping us to discover what may be important in going on, that's going on in the brains of these individuals.
Well, you're hinting at this. Many of us will not meditate for 34,000 hours in our lifetimes. I know you've looked at shorter spans of time. Can short bursts, I don't think burst is a good word for meditation, but short spells of meditation make a noticeable difference in our brains? Can we see start to see a bit of that same kind of signal?
It's such an American question. But after
can
all,
we do
here
it fast,
are.
Man?
Right. And the answer is yes, we can see changes in the brain after really short periods of practice, which is quite amazing. We published a study a couple of years ago in complete novices, and we had them go through 2 weeks of training. where they were practicing about 30 minutes a day, so it was a total of 7 hours. And we did brain scans, MRI scans, on these participants before and after this 2-week period of practice. And sure enough, we were able to see changes after just this short period of time. So it is the case that really short periods of time can make a difference. And I would say that even less than a half an hour is perfectly acceptable and can produce real change. And when individuals come to me and say, well, they just can't meditate and doing 30 minutes is impossible, start with 2 minutes, really short periods. And then one can gradually build up. And it's sort of like physical exercise. You wouldn't jump into doing a major marathon if you are completely out of shape, but you can start slowly and begin to see if this is something that is producing benefit.
Richard Davidson is a UW-Madison neuroscientist who studies the effects of mindfulness on the brain. We'll hear the rest of that conversation after Look at the News with Kristen Durst. Last week, Veronica Rickert and I talked to Richard Davidson, one of the world's foremost authorities on the brain and mindfulness. We pick up that conversation now with the question, are people basically good?
One of the things I know you're looking at now that's been a little bit more controversial, but there is some evidence starting to pile up, is that maybe people are innately good. And by that I mean maybe they lean a little toward altruism. If they have a choice between the two, they're going to pick the positive. What do you know about where we are on that?
Yeah, it's a great question, Veronica, and I love to talk about this. And it's a burgeoning area of scientific interest. You're quite right that it is more controversial than some of the other topics, largely because the evidence is not yet as robust as we would like. But there's increasing evidence to suggest that if an individual is given a choice between an altruistic and a warm-hearted encounter compared to one that is selfish, competitive, aggressive, the individual will consistently choose the warm-hearted, altruistic encounter. And these biases that I call innate basic goodness can be discerned very early in life. And I can give you an example of that. But, you know, it's when we think about it, people don't sign up for courses to learn how to become more angry or more sad. They do sign up for things where they can learn how to become more happy and improve their well-being. And so there is some kind of face valid evidence that there isn't a natural predisposition for people to increase their negative emotions. The evidence in young infants is particularly interesting. If we show a very young infant, say 6 months of age, a short video clip depicting a warm-hearted, altruistic encounter compared to one that is selfish, the 6-month-old infant will consistently prefer the warm-hearted, altruistic encounter. Now, how do we know a 6-month-old infant would prefer it? You ask them. And the way we ask a 6-month-old infant is one way we could do it is by monitoring very carefully with infrared eye tracking. We can monitor their eye movements. And so we can look to see where they're looking. And they prefer to look at the warm-hearted, altruistic encounter compared to one that is very, very carefully matched on all other characteristics but depicts a selfish and aggressive encounter.
Staying with positive behavior, I know you've been talking about generosity lately as a positive behavior that brings us benefits and maybe reinforces more positive behavior in the future.
Yeah, so generosity is really an interesting one. We've recently written this piece that's part of the UN World Happiness Report that came out in April of 2015. And this is the first year, this is the third year that this report has come out. It's the first year that there's a section on neuroscience in that report, and we wrote that section on the neuroscience of well-being, and we talk about 4 different constituents of well-being that have been neuroscientifically investigated and validated. And one of those, interestingly, is generosity. The act of generosity activates circuits in the brain very, very powerfully. that are associated with positive emotion. Giving, you know, the Dalai Lama has been saying this for years, the most effective strategy for promoting happiness is to be generous to others. And the data, the neuroscientific data, are consistent with that. And there are also psychological data that are consistent with that. There are these crazy studies that social psychologists have done where people come into the lab in the morning and they're given $100 in cash and they're told, go spend this money on whatever you'd like that you have felt guilty about buying for yourself. Here's $100. The only constraint is you must spend every penny on yourselves. Another group that's randomly assigned is given the same $100 and told to spend that money for gifts for others. And they come back in the lab at the end of the day. Guess which group shows a very significant boost in happiness? Of course, it's the group who is purchasing gifts for others. And so there's a lot of evidence to suggest that generosity really does promote well-being.
That's so interesting, because you think you spend so much time trying to hang on to your acquisitions and protect things even for your family, but are you saying we might actually be putting a ding in our own happiness by doing that, that if we would just focus on giving away, we could have measurable increase in well-being and happiness?
Yeah, this is the premise, Veronica, of Dan Gilbert's book, Stumbling on Happiness. Dan Gilbert is a psychologist at Harvard, a colleague and a good friend, and wrote this book called Stumbling on Happiness. And that's exactly the premise, that we misconstrue the causes of our own happiness. And the empirical work does clearly suggest that beyond a certain minimal level of material possessions, that anything beyond that really does not contribute in any significant way to our happiness.
Didn't they used to put a price tag on it, though, and money can buy happiness, say, up to $50,000 or something like that? What do you think about that?
Well, I think that there are important elements of truth in that. And so beyond some minimal basic level of support, the data, from my perspective, really does not suggest that increased income beyond that is linearly associated with happiness.
Another area I think you've been looking at is epigenetics, they call it. So we've got our genes, and we used to kind of think of it as a blueprint. The genes lead directly to this. It's way more complicated than that. Some genes get activated, some don't. What are you looking at in that area?
Yeah, so that's a great question. What's happening in genomics is kind of parallel to what's happened with neuroplasticity and neuroscience. There's much more dynamic change in these systems than we previously thought was possible. You can think of genes having little volume controls, many genes, and these volume controls regulate the extent to which a gene is turned on or turned off. And it turns out that our emotions, our demeanor, our the qualities of our well-being impact that. And there are specific practices that impact that, specific training. And we published a paper last year showing that one intensive day of meditation, 8 hours among experienced meditators, was sufficient to produce a measurable change in their gene expression. And we had control participants come into the laboratory for a day of leisure. And we saw no change in those individuals who had the same sedentary day. So it appears that the regulation of our genes is under much more dynamic control. And this really has profoundly important impact for our health, because a lot of these genes are affected by practices that can promote well-being are genes involved in, for example, inflammation. And we know that inflammation is at the core of many chronic illnesses.
And I know another area of interest to you particularly is your work with children. So you're looking at how some of these mindfulness practices, cultivating kindness, things like that, can have an impact on the young developing brain. Can you tell us a little bit about where your research is leading you there?
Yeah, so this is really an extension of our work. We call it translational research, where we take the insights that we have gleaned from basic research in the laboratory and bring it out to real-world contexts. And we reason that if we can help young children to promote positive qualities of mind and provide them with simple exercises and skills that can then become lifelong, we could potentially, with modest interventions early on, have multiplicative effects as the children develop. When we first began to think about this, we went to the Dalai Lama and I asked him for advice about what kinds of practices would be most appropriate for young children, and he just looked at me and started laughing hysterically and said, "I've never had children, so I have no idea." So he said, "Please use science to investigate this." So that's what we've been doing, and we've developed a curriculum that we call the Kindness Curriculum, which is a curriculum that right now is focused for preschool children. We have been implementing this in the Madison Metropolitan School District in randomized controlled trials, and the first scientific paper based on this curriculum just came out this year, just a couple of months ago, showing really positive benefit from a 12-week curriculum that teaches children simple practices of mindfulness and kindness.
Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Richard Davidson, director of the Wiseman Laboratory for Brain Imaging and Behavior and founder of the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds at UW-Madison. We spoke to him at an event last week.